How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
What's up, Open Fork Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line, as always, by Michael the Pod Pina, who's writing everywhere on the internet covering these NBA playoffs, including 538 and GQ. Michael, we are coming in hot off an incredible Game 6 between the Boston Celtics and the Toronto Raptors. I would call it the greatest game of the bubble so far, you know, full stop, no exceptions whatsoever. It was the most entertaining. It was the highest stakes. It absolutely felt like a real playoff game, even though there weren't that many people in the stands. Michael, I was so excited during the end game that I was actually physically moving from one media section to the other in hopes of capturing the ultimate game-winning shot or the game-winning moment. I was going back and forth like sort of offense-defense substitutions of myself watching the final moments of that game. That's how tight it was down the stretch of the two overtime periods. I believe I could hear you sobbing on the other end of this phone call after Boston's, you know, atrocious loss there. Not exactly what we expected from Boston after their big commanding Game 5 win. Walk me through your range of emotions on a scale of, you know, 10 to 10. How heartbroken are you? I imagine a 10. And how panicky are you right now heading into Game 7 that maybe Toronto is going to big brother Boston after all?
Yeah, so basically what you're telling me is that you distracted the Celtics. You were walking up and down the sidelines, just like Nick Nurse on that last play where he's crouched in the corner, just confusing Jason Tatum. Just, I don't want to use the C word and say that he's a cheater, but...
Let me just say this, Michael. Nick Nurse and I are running a great 1-2-man game. You'll remember Nick Nurse pulling out all the stops trying to push Pascal Siakam's buttons after Game 5. And I personally pulled out all the stops, deciding to give Boston credit as a championship-worthy team for the first time since the last time they actually won a title. I've been dismissing these guys for more than a decade. I finally turned the corner earlier this week to say, oh, yeah, okay, they've got all the pieces. The only thing they don't have is, you know, the rings are already won, that experience, but they've put the rest of the package together. And what do you know? Just a monumental loss immediately in response. I think between Nurse and I, we successfully jinxed the Celtics and possibly ruined your life. This could go down as one of my greatest podcasting accomplishments in history. Again, you know, I'm not getting too cocky here. There's still one more game to play. Obviously, both teams have to be ready for Game 7, Michael. But I'm glad that you're back on your heels a little bit and sweating.
You're a despicable person. I just want to get that on the record. Now, I mean, it was truly the best game of the bubble so far. I don't think there's anything that touches it. I mean... could have gone either way. There was some ridiculous shots by both sides, ridiculous defensive plays by both sides, controversial calls. It had it all. It was a great game. I am, to answer your question, 10 out of 10, heartbroken. But I am also feeling pretty confident heading into Game 7. I just think, like, when you play that many minutes, if you're Kyle Lowry, who had – that was maybe the – I don't want to say that was the best game of his career because game six of last year's finals was pretty tremendous. But like Kyle Lowry playing 54 minutes, Fred VanVleet playing 50 minutes, Pascal Siakam playing 54 minutes. They had, you know, the Celtics played a ton of minutes too and rode their guys. But like, I don't know. Kyle Lowry's not young. So I'm feeling confident about game seven still.
No, back in my early writing days, Michael, I was running a Ford Taurus, 1996 Ford Taurus, into the ground, and I kept getting tow trucks involved because it was dying on me, you know, moment after moment. And at some point, the guy was like, you know, it would probably be just smarter and cheaper for you to get a new car. And, you know, I think that's sort of the stage that the Raptors are at. They're at that last gas, 96 for Torres. Can this thing hold up for one more game and kind of outlast a really good Boston team? To me, I think that could be the deciding factor in Game 7 because the Raptors had to ramp up their guys' minutes earlier in this series and to higher levels than Boston did, right? I mean, pretty much starting from Game 3, Lowry started playing just massive amounts of minutes. He is such a character. You know, he had the picture of his stitches, you know, from taking the elbow to his face that he was proudly showing off to us in the post-game press conference last night. I mean, he's just swearing up a storm like always. It was vintage Kyle Lowry. We got a bunch of emails from people. Is he a Hall of Famer? Is he a Hall of Famer? That sounded crazy to me before last year's finals, any kind of talk like that. I think he's there now. I don't know where you stand
no
on
question.
The...
Yeah. No question. I mean, once you win the title and you have the performance that he did in that series, I mean, it was kind of just like a capstone on a very impressive career. One of the most underrated players in the NBA to this day. I mean, if you go on Basketball Reference and you look at the top 10 MVP candidates for the 2019-20 season, he's like 8 or 9, I think, which is just like, he's remarkable. He's their best player, in my opinion, their most consistent player. Even when he's not shooting the ball well, he impacts the game in so many different ways. We're going to go through this game, and I have a million different possessions in my mind that Kyle Lowry just kept me up last night. He's a definite Hall of Famer, in my opinion.
And I was going to say, I think the strongest argument now in favor of his Hall of Fame candidacy, it's like the visceral factor. Like, everybody has a Kyle Lowry take, right? You might hate him because of all the little tricks, but I think especially over the last 18 months, you've come to respect all those little plays that he's making, but he's still scoring, you know, a lot. He's still orchestrating the offense. He's doing basically everything. There's no way to avoid him. I mean, the Kyle Lowry experience is sort of like an all-encompassing, overwhelming kind of sensation here of these last couple of playoffs. And so I just think by the time he retires, people are going to look back and be like, oh, man, Lowry in 2019, Lowry in 2020. And even if he had, a lot of struggles earlier in his career, frankly, with scoring efficiency and trying to get where he wanted to go on the court and everything else, I think that stuff's going to fade by the wayside. People are just going to remember him as sort of like this quintessential figure for the Raptors, somebody who was, you know, kind of polarizing, I guess, in a good way. And then obviously a great leader, too. And I think that's more than enough to get him in. So you mentioned maybe some of the research or going back to watch aspects of this late game situation. I think, you know, kind of big picture first, kind of easy softball question. Did Toronto deserve to win this game, or did both teams deserve to win this game, or did Boston just like inexplicably blow it? It was so frantic there at the end. There were so many different situations where, like, you know, one call or one shot goes the other direction. It ends at a different point. There was some brain farts that certainly, I think, kind of came back to bite Boston a little bit. But did the right team win here, Michael?
Yeah, I'm not going to say. You know, it's funny, actually, like, if you look at the points per possession numbers, I mean, 99.9 times out of 100, the team that wins that margin wins the game, because that's how math it works. But if you look at this game, the Celtics actually had a point, they were plus 0.3 points per possession in this game, and they lost. So that's just like a weird thing that kind of shows how much of a coin flip this was.
Can we hang that banner if they lose here and don't make the conference finals? Can we hang? That sounds like a very Daryl Morey type thing to do. Let's hang a banner for our math victory, even though it didn't quite pan out on the scoreboard. That's hilarious. I didn't know that. Fascinating little fact. It's a reminder of how close this game was. I'm curious, was the deciding factor Nick Nurse's decision to go small? I mean, we talked about the heavy minutes that both teams, you know, main groups played, especially down the stretch. I mean, there really was no major substituting going on late in the fourth quarter in overtime. And Nick Nurse kind of threw a curveball to everyone. He played a lineup that he's only played for 9 minutes during the regular season. It had Lowry, Fred VanVleet, Pascal Siakam, Norman Powell, who is usually a bench player, and then OG Anunoby. He takes Anunoby, who's a 6'7" wing, puts him as his center against Daniel Tice in the middle. So he's obviously a little bit outclassed from a height perspective, but he's hanging in there toughness-wise as best he can. you know, down the stretch, there's some clear trade-offs for Toronto. I mean, Tice is going on this dunk parade, this layup parade throughout overtimes. They're doing a great job of getting lobs to him and kind of punishing Toronto for its lack of, you know, rim protection and big men. And yet the trade-offs for Toronto wind up being, well, you've got a number of turnovers forced on the perimeter because your defense is pretty locked in and super versatile. And then on the other end, you've got Norman Powell really stepping up, especially in the second overtime period, to kind of bring that win home. I think if we look back in hindsight, I mean, first of all, we could say Coach Bud would never in a million years have figured this one out. I mean, he never would have cracked this code. You know,
I love that you just found a way to dig at poor Coach Bud when we're talking about a game between the Raptors and the Celtics.
I mean, we did that whole exercise where what happens if we switch coaches between Spo and Bud, right? And we talk about, okay, well, what does Milwaukee look like? What does Miami look like in those situations? Yet again, you know, you see, and look, I mean, did Nurse pull a rabbit out of his hat? That's a legitimate counter argument to say he got a little bit lucky. It's not like they won. This wasn't a death lineup situation where they're winning those minutes like 50-15, and all of a sudden he's the smartest coach ever. I mean, I think it was like 37-33 down the stretch, right? No, but it did work. I mean, ultimately we got to give him credit for it working, right?
It worked, but I also just think that that was, like, I don't want to call it a no-brainer at all, but, like, what are the other options here? Like, Serge Ibaka, who I don't think on that ankle he's going to be playing humongous minutes in this game and being productive, and he is somewhat of a liability on the defensive end in certain spots. And then you have Marc Gasol, who...
Slow down real quick on that one.
Sure.
So... Ibaka has been playing those minutes previously, right? And you go back all season long, it's either Ibaka or Gasol is in pretty much every one of their lineups, and I think usually they kind of prefer Ibaka. The way I look at it is Gasol is like the XL option, Ibaka is the L option, right? And then now OG Anunoby is like the medium option, right? So they've usually been in that L option with Ibaka. This is a player who's been multiple all-defensive teams. He's a veteran. He's a champion. He's respected. He's got a longer track record than our buddy Russell Westbrook in Houston, right? And we've talked about how difficult it is for a coach like D'Antoni to take Russell Westbrook off the court in those crunch time moments. And here's Nick Nurse looking at not only Ibaka, but also a former Defensive Player of the Year guy in Marc Gasol and saying, look, our season is on the line. I have an idea here. Let's play a 23-year-old forward from London as our center. What do you think? That's not a small decision. I'm with you. He was backed into a corner a little bit, and the injury did make it slightly easier. But you know what I'm getting at from the ego and the experience and then just like doing right by your players? Like those kind of arguments, that's not how Nick Nurse was really approaching this one. I think it stands in contrast to D'Antoni as well.
Yeah, I think that maybe, yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think politically it's a lot more palatable to pull Serge Ibaka than Russell Westbrook, who's making $700 million over the next 10 years on his current contract, and you're kind of stuck with that.
Agree, but should it be? I mean, come on. Should we just be making the right basketball calls here rather than worrying about guys' contracts? I know this is like, you know, dream fantasy land over here, but I just think if, you know, if the Rockets treated Westbrook like Nurse treated Ibaka, they might be in a better spot right now.
Maybe. I think at the end of the day that going small in that spot was like just, again, I don't think it was like a no-brainer. It didn't stun me at all when I was watching the game. I was like, oh, they're playing Pascal at the five or OG Anunoby at the five, and this is what they're going to do. They have shooting at all five positions. They are even more versatile. They can do more things defensively. Kemba did not have a great shooting performance, but he was still kind of just getting where he wanted on the floor. So that was made things a little bit easier, for them trying to slow him down. So you kind of just add that all that up. And then obviously the results with Norm Powell hitting, I guess he made probably the three biggest shots arguably of down the stretch. I mean, Lowry obviously had the nail in the coffin with the fall away with 11 seconds left, and then OG Anunoby hit that monstrous three-pointer from the top of the key. But Norm Powell was huge, hit that corner three, hit the wing three, and then he obviously had the and one where he stripped Jason Tatum to put Toronto up four, I think, in that double overtime. But yeah, so like, I think you kind of, like, you look at the results and you're like, this was a genius move. But I think it was the right one, regardless of the outcome of the game. And Nick Nurse, I mean, luck goes into all of this, right? Like, Nick Nurse is lucky that Norm Powell hit both of those threes. Because if he didn't, the game was kind of tilting in Boston's direction finally, where they were in position on before both of those shots to go up two possession, make it a two possession game. And a two possession game in a game like that just felt like a four touchdown lead. And so those were humongous shots, and he had him in the game for a reason, I guess.
Yeah, and look, if he doesn't come through and step up, people are going to be questioning, why did he get the final shot, you know, against the buzzer? You know,
I'm still questioning that, for the record. That was a weird one.
Yeah, so Nurse's explanation on that was he just liked it. He thought that Powell had the ability to rise up and get a pretty clean jumper. He didn't want to do anything that could lead to a turnover on that possession. And he thought that there would be a more favorable matchup between Powell and whoever was guarding him, compared to, I guess, Lowry or whoever else might have been trying to go for an isolation shot. So that was his reasoning. It did feel very strange in the moment, and then it was like fully justified, you know, like a few minutes later. So it's hilarious to see the Twitter second guessers have to kind of like, you know, retract their criticisms as Norman Powell can't miss in the second overtime. Very fun game from the you know, from the Toronto perspective. But let's dig into the unfun side of this game from the Boston Celtics perspective. Now, Michael, the eye test told me that Jason Tatum had a couple of regrettable decisions there down the stretch. The box score told me he had six turnovers, and I know that there's also Kemba Walker looming here as a possible scapegoat because he basically did absolutely nothing all night, as far as I could tell. I mean, he played a lot of minutes, but didn't.
Oh my God! Okay, continue.
Didn't do a ton out there. So I guess, first of all, I'm curious, when you're looking back on this, do you pin this loss on anyone in particular? Did Brad get out foxed? Should he have gone even smaller when OG's at the center, and maybe he brings in, I don't know, Brad Wanamaker for Tice or something like that? Or should Tatum have done something different, approach that end game a little bit different? Did they just simply run out of gas? What was going on with Kemba? Please give me the debrief. Like, what the heck happened here from Boston's side?
I mean, I thought Boston played like pretty well, all things considered. And obviously Kemba did not shoot the ball well. I thought he was fouled at the end of regulation pretty clearly and should have gone to the free throw line. But, you know, calls go, I think it all evens out at the end of the day, especially in a double overtime game like that. And Kemba also had an opportunity late, I think it was in the first overtime, or maybe it was the fourth quarter, where he just missed this floater after he burned Pascal Siakam off the bounce. That, I mean, he short-armed it in a way that he usually doesn't. Like, that's kind of his sweet spot. So he had a rough shooting night. I think as a playmaker, as I was saying before, like, he, you know, he set up Tice over and over again down the stretch. And, I mean, they boxed in one, put a box in one on Kemba, which is just like the ultimate sign of respect, basically from the start of the game. And that was a huge factor in his poor statistical output. I think, you know, I went back because you emailed me the outline last night and you asked me to be prepared to be Jason Tatum's defense attorney. So,
well, I'm just saying, I mean, it was kind of meltdown city there a little bit. I mean, I don't want to dig in too deep here, but it was not necessarily like, you know, an in your prime Kawhi Leonard bringing that victory home. And actually, two real quick points on Kemba before we move on. Sure. And before you can, you know, defend your favorite player's honor. Sam Amick of The Athletic had a nice note where after that non-call on the foul, Kemba went over to Monty McCutchen and was, you know, screaming for help. You know, Monty's always sitting there courtside. So that's actually a Chris Paul vet move here in the bubble to take your complaint to the manager. And Kemba got in on that as well. It didn't help him necessarily, but that's how frustrated he was with no call there. And then also Nurse basically attributed his entire decision to go small late in the game to his desire to better defend Kemba Walker. He said their big guys were struggling a little bit too much to both take away Walker's jumpers, but then also kind of recover once he tries to, you know, scoot to the basket and break down the defense off the dribble. So as I'm kind of mocking, you know, Kemba's stat line, and you're doing a nice job of defending his honor, as I assumed you would, we should point out that, you know, he was commanding basically all of Toronto's respect by kind of forcing them towards that lineup, something that they had not done essentially all season long. So that's the sign of a star in theory, even if not in practice. All right, Michael, tell us what happened to Jason Tatum late.
I mean, Tatum was, I went back and I watched the whole fourth quarter. I watched both overtimes. I did not see anything that was particularly glaring in terms of a need to criticize this person or posit him as a scapegoat. I mean,
I have three beefs. Okay, I'm gonna start off as the
prosecution,
and you can take over as the defense. Number one beef: he threw to Nick Nurse, and then they're trying to whine and blame that on Nick Nurse. I mean, come on, Nick Nurse does not look like any of the players on the Celtics. He probably looks the most like Tice, but he doesn't look that much like Tice. Careless turnover. He's got to own that one. You can't be calling out, whatever Jalen said about, is Toronto's, coaching staff getting a little bit too emotional or competitive or whatever he said. I mean, come on. That's weak sauce. That's number one. Number two, there was a situation late. I'm not sure which overtime period. The ball swung to Tatum, top of the key. He was pretty wide open, or at least I thought he had a clean shooting look for a three right at the top, and he just passed up and didn't take the shot. I wanted him to take that shot. It felt like that was kind of a moment for him to potentially be a hero. Split-second decision. I'm not really that mad about it, but I did think that that was a moment where if it was Marcus Smart in the same situation, he's taking the shot, right? Number three beef, what the heck happened with 5 seconds left on the clock? Okay, they had no timeouts. They lost. To me, they lost entirely control of the time score situation. Kemba Walker is standing in front of Jason Tatum, clapping his hands, just asking for the ball so he can run it up the court and go get a shot. Instead, Tatum throws a pretty accurate long-distance pass to Smart. Smart also loses track of time score and launches this crazy turnaround three-pointer that's contested with 5 seconds left rather than trying to get himself a better shot. They just straight panicked, bro. They were not ready for that moment. And I put a lot of it on Tatum because he was the inbounder and because the obvious option to just inbound to Kemba was staring right in front of him wide open. It wasn't like he was even being guarded at that point. Those are my major beefs with Tatum. All right, go ahead.
I have absolutely no clue what you're talking about on that last play. I thought that was a fine quarter length of the court, three quarters of the length of the court pass to Marcus Smart.
With 5 seconds left, all you're going to get is a contested 30-foot turnaround when you could have Kemba run the ball up the court in 3 seconds and get you a good look? I mean, come on.
I rewatched this play multiple times because it gave me an aneurysm. And Marcus Smart catches the ball. Kemba sprints up the floor, and he's wide open behind the arc, and he's screaming for the ball. And so I kind of put it more on Marcus taking that shot. And I know it's like 5 seconds left. I can't even imagine with everything that's going on, how chaotic it is going on in his brain. And trying to you don't want the clock to run out without a shot. That's like the worst case scenario. And that's the number one thing that everyone on the floor is trying to prevent. But at the same time, Kemba was wide open, and if Marcus saw him and was looking to pass, and I also just like don't know how much of this was scripted, because it's not a coincidence necessarily that Marcus Smart was wide open with only one defender back there.
Scripted, because that was a terrible script. I mean, like, okay. Throw that one in the trash. Come on. That was like, worse than the Sopranos ending, right? I mean, come on.
All right.
If you have 5 seconds left, you've got to be able to do better than that. And I'm sure if they could do it over, they would have either just inbounded to Kemba, or they would have, tried to have like something where you throw ahead to Marcus and he pitches back to somebody and he kind of walks into a shot, right? Because just everything about it from the start of the pass to Smart's shot made it seem like they thought they had 0.5 seconds, right? Like they were really up against the gun as opposed to having 5 seconds. You can create a lot of good shots in the NBA in 5 seconds. It does not take these guys very long to sprint up the court and hit a runner. I mean, we've seen LeBron hit, full court, runners off one leg, banking in shots with less than 5 seconds before in playoff games. I mean, I just think that there was a lack of poise in that moment. I don't think that's me being rude here, Michael.
Okay. I think you are being rude. But let me just zoom out and just read Jason Tatum's box score. Box score is not everything, but he finished with 29 points, 9 assists. The 6 turnovers that you mentioned, I think 3 of them were on offensive fouls, which, you know, whatever. 14 rebounds, 4 for 8 behind the 3-point line. He hit with the Celtics were down 4 with 33 seconds left. They drop a play for Tatum. He goes right at Kyle Lowry, hits a tough floater. A couple possessions later, he hits a 28-foot three-pointer to cut it to the lead to 1 with 6 seconds to go. So, I mean, like, if you're just looking at how he performed as a scorer down the stretch when it really mattered, I thought he was pretty terrific. I think throughout both overtimes, throughout the fourth quarter, they were trying to, it was either Kemba. They were basically running a Kemba Tatum high screen and roll to try to get a mismatch either for Kemba or for Tatum. Just on basically every, that's how they initiated every offensive possession at the end of the game in both of the overtimes. And I thought that whenever Tatum had a situation where he was isolated on either Van Vliet or Lowry at the top of the key in a spot where it's really difficult to double, I mean, the Toronto Raptors, you got to give them credit because they had everybody in the paint in these situations. There was no way Tatum was driving. His options here were basically to take a tough, contested, fall-away mid-range shot, not one you really want. And he's not really in a position also to take those, you know, he loves like the one dribble fall-away or the sidestep jumper, and it's really difficult to take those with a small guard like Lowry or Van Vliet on him. Those guys are just picking everybody's pocket left and right. So in these spots, like, he read the defense, he made great passes, he assisted 2 Marcus Smart corner threes, he found Jaylen Brown, I think, for 3 corner threes, 2 of them wide open. Jaylen ended up hitting one of them. And I just thought he was, like, super poised and just about every spot except, I don't know if it's the same possession you mentioned earlier where he passed up the open three, but there was a spot where the ball got swung to him and he just was not shot ready in the second, I think it was the second overtime. Second overtime, like 40 seconds to go or something like that. Marcus Smart swings the ball to him. He's not shot ready. Stares at the rim and tries to drive the closeout. Norm Powell picks his pocket, goes the other way, and one. And that was basically the ball game right there. That put the Raptors up 4.
Yeah, that's definitely a situation where I'm not sure we're using the word poised, Michael. I mean, come on, that's pretty rough.
Guy makes one mistake. I mean, I said this before, perfect is the enemy of very good. Perfect is the enemy of very good. I thought he was a fine player in this game. And he was defensively great, I think, in spots. I mean, he was not a liability at all. He had that one chase down block on, I think it was Norm Powell, if I'm not mistaken, that was pretty impressive. I mean, all over the glass. Like, I don't know. Like, I can't really fault Tatum here. It's not like he was shying away from the moment. It was, I give more credit to Toronto's defense and just the way that they strategically tried to limit Tatum and limit Kemba and force everybody else to beat them.
I think that we've got arguably a hung jury here. I'm not sure you convinced me necessarily, but you did a very valiant job in your Tatum defense. I mean, a couple thoughts. First of all, the standard right now for him is super duper high because he's been so good that he's built the expectations up, right? So if this was the same Tatum that we were talking about during last year's playoffs, at that stage of his career, I think that he wouldn't be facing the same level of microscope on these, you know, flash moments, you know, these split second decisions, whether it's do I shoot, do I drive, do I kick to the corner and it winds up being a guy who plays guitar and not one of my teammates who actually gets the ball? Do I panic on the inbounds and just kind of lose my mind for a split second? I think those kinds of things would be swept under the rug. He's made a leap this year, and I think that expectations have leaped along with him. I think it sets him up for game 7. I mean, it's not like this is some, like, you know, crucible of his reputation. He's going to be a bum if they don't get it done. But I do think it's a really interesting test moment for him. Like, you know, Brad Stevens talks so much in Game 5 about the competitive character of the Celtics and how they responded after, you know, Kyle Lowry's Game 4 performance and after OG's shot in Game 3. I mean, here is another even bigger test for those young guys, and we'll see if they're ready for it. You know, like I said earlier, I think the minutes thing, the lack of, you know, the super fatigue will definitely play to Boston's benefit. I thought they came out really strong as a team in Game 6, and that's a strong sign, too. You know you're going to get the Raptors' best punch in that moment, and to still kind of dictate the terms of that game early is a positive sign for the Celtics. But to me, he just wasn't good enough late. It wasn't a disaster. I'm not giving him an F. I'm not flunking him. I just think, like, if he's going to look back, he's going to have some serious regrets from that endgame sequence. And I suspect his lawyer would, too, frankly, to be honest. You know, if they wind up losing this series, don't you think you're going to look back at some of those overtimes in Game 6 and be like, man, if just this had gone the other way, if he had just done this, this would be a whole different story.
Absolutely not. No, I can't go over there with you. I love how you just stick to the inbound pass with 5 seconds to go in a 3-point game, the play where Nick Nurse was blatantly cheating, and that's basically it for you. I mean, you're overlooking the box score, the 29 points, which is, that's what you want from an all-star player, right?
Scorer. No, because it's 29 points, .. in a losing effort. That's not what you want from an all-star.
So if they win that game, which, this was the ultimate coin flip game, and, like, Kyle Lowry was throwing up some junk in that game, and OG Anunoby has
been
just
Kyle Lowry was a lot better than Jason Tatum in this game. I'm sorry.
I'm not saying that Kyle Lowry was not as good. I'm just saying that he was throwing up some junk, and a couple of those shots are highly inefficient for anyone, including him, and they just happen to go in. And so, I mean, like, I can't just judge someone on a coin flip game whether or not their team won or lost when I thought that they played pretty well. I mean, the one time that Tatum was like, you know what, I am – screw this defense. I am putting my head down. I'm getting a step on Pascal Siakam. I'm going right at the basket. The one time he really did that in both overtimes, he drew like every defender into the paint as was expected, and he tried to find Tice on a drop pass and basically did not connect with Tice and turned the ball over and it went the other way, and I think Lowry hit like a three. So like he, you know, it's like he made one mistake in that spot, and it's just like, I don't know. There's some growing pains here. I thought he played, I'm not going to say he played tremendous. I think he played a pretty damn good basketball game, though.
I think you did a pretty darn good job defending him. That, to me, I was just kind of honestly just wanted to torture you a little bit. It felt so good to hear you squirm and have to defend Tatum and how personal it got. I just, you know, mm-hmm. after a really tough week for Giannis and the Milwaukee Bucks and being back on the defensive, it was so nice to hear someone else, you know, feel my pain in a slightly different way. Hey, Michael, we got a lot of questions from the Open Floor Globe this week. They emailed us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. And I wanted to start with Usman because he makes a good point. He says, longtime listener, Miami Heat fan here. I listened to your latest podcast going over the series, and I am utterly and thoroughly disappointed, just like me and Jason Tatum, by the way. You guys spent 30 minutes talking about the series, and 25 minutes were spent talking about the Bucks and what they did wrong and not giving Eric Spoelstra and his guys a lick of credit. Then you spent the next 5 minutes giving backhanded compliments and roasting Miami's chances going forward, which, by the way, I agree with. They don't look great, but that's beside the point. The worst part is it seemed Ben, who was framing these questions, you were self-aware and you knew what you were doing the whole time. You even called that Heat question a charity question, and then you said, why do we treat the Heat this way? We need to have a better conversation about the Miami Heat. Usman, look, I hear you loud and clear. Remember sometimes my tongue's in my cheek when I make those kinds of comments. We were obviously dealing with the headline news, which is the Bucks implosion. I think that we handled that one properly, in my opinion. Talking at length about what went wrong, what the implications could be for Milwaukee. I mean, to me, that is the headline story. But Usman's got a great point, too, which is the Miami Heat, this team that we really haven't heard from since LeBron left in a big-time way on the postseason stage, are back in the Eastern Conference Finals. They're going to be resting for darn near a week before they get either Boston or hopefully Toronto in the Eastern Conference Finals. And they're in a situation where they're going deep into their rotation. They've got a lot of guys who are contributing, shooting the basketball well. They've got Jimmy Butler, who outplayed Giannis head-to-head in the second-round series. They're coming off a situation where they swept the Indiana Pacers, you know, a team that had a pretty similar regular season record to them. So that's utter domination in the first round. And things are rolling. The vibes are really good. I think, you know, Pitbull and Rick Ross have to be very proud of this group. No questions about it. So let's dig into you know, a couple of these questions, maybe for Usman's benefit and also for the entire 305. I want to know, Michael, what would you view as Miami's biggest advantage in the Eastern Conference Finals? You know, whether it's Boston, you know, or Toronto, like, what do you feel like is their sort of signature strength that they might have in one of those matchups?
I just think, like, I put myself in the position of Nick Nurse or Brad Stevens, and I just think Miami's greatest advantage is that it's so difficult to game plan to stop their offense. There's just so many different options, so many different variations that they go to, so many different players who they can lean on. And so, like, when you have such a limited amount of time to put together a game plan and to scout, like, it's impossible to cover everything. It's so much different than the Bucks or the Lakers and or the Rockets. Like, you kind of just, like, know what those teams are going to do on offense on any given night, whereas Miami is just so broad with how they want to attack you. And you've got Jimmy pick and rolls. You've got Goran Dragic just ramming the ball down your throat in transition. You've got Tyler Hero coming out of nowhere who has just, like, perma green light, and he's hitting everything. You got shooters just, like, at all times, everybody on the floor basically can shoot, except Bam Adebayo, who might be their best or most important, one of their most important players. And just the way that he can just draw opposing bigs out without a jump shot, like, in the similar vein to Draymond Green running those DHOs from up top. Like, you kind of, if you're a big, you have to be up there to help, because if he runs a dribble handoff with Duncan Robinson and there's only one defender there, that's going to be a wide open three for one of the best 3-point shooters who's basically ever lived. So they're just tough, man. They have so many different ways they can beat you. They have a great, great, great head coach. And that's what I would be worried about the most. Like, I don't know what to hone in on when I'm trying to slow them down.
So even Usman admitted that, you know, this joyride that the Miami Heat are on, which has been amazing, and their offense, as you're mentioning, has been really, really tough to stop. And you're just constantly playing whack-a-mole with those guys because, you know, pretty much every lineup they put out there has at minimum 4 scoring threats, right? Or, you know, if it's not individual scoring threats, at least guys who present problems and create space for their teammates. But is any of it fool's gold, I guess, is kind of my question. I think there'd be some people who say, like, I mean, Jay Crowder has had an amazing month, right? Playing some of the most important basketball of his entire career, shooting the lights out. I mean, big three after big three right in front of Milwaukee's bench in game 5. I mean, Giannis was about to have his eyes roll back into his head after a couple of those shots he was hitting. And full credit to Crowder, because he was just in the groove. I mean, every time he's shooting, you feel like it's going in. Is there a chance guys like Crowder, Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, I mentioned those last two because they're just a little bit less experienced, and, you know, typically we expect, you know, guys in their type of role to fade at some point in the playoffs. Is it possible that they come back to earth and the entire Miami formula looks different? Like, if you think if they were going against one of these elite defenses, whether it's Toronto or Boston, both of whom I think are a little bit better equipped on the wings to defend all those guys than Milwaukee was, is there going to be a situation where if those guys get locked up or taken away, or even if they just come back to earth, now all of a sudden Miami looks pretty mortal? Is that a concern you have? It's definitely one I have.
Yeah, if their top 3 3-point shooters stop hitting threes, I think they'll be in trouble.
I'm not saying that they're going to disappear, but you know what I mean. Like, the margins here are pretty tight, right? And so, like, if Crowder just comes back to earth slightly And, you know, Robinson winds up, you know, they just do a better job. Whoever in the Eastern Conference Finals does a better job of just kind of taking him out, right? You know, which we've seen, you know, teams do on guys like J.J. Redick or whoever else you want to compare. Like those strict three-point shooters can get taken away in a playoff series. It doesn't take a ton to me to kind of just shake up Miami's entire offensive formula, I guess.
No, I mean, that's kind of why we're all surprised, I think, that Miami has had this much success. I mean, I think part of it is the matchup advantage that they had against Milwaukee. So maybe surprise isn't the right word, but just the fact that they, as a, what are they, a five seed, I think, four or five seed, to get to the conference finals is surprising because they have, you know, their best player is Jimmy Butler. And then from there, they really don't have a traditional sidekick scoring option. I mean, like, it's basically Goran Dragic, who he's a game-tilting presence, no doubt, but not really someone who you can consistently rely upon, like a Chris Middleton, or I guess, like, an even more serious example would be, like, Paul George, someone like that. So they don't have that type of star power, and they're built differently, so I get the concern. I think Crowder has, you know, he's shooting 40% from behind the three-point line on 8 3-point attempts per game in the playoffs. That's probably unsustainable, you would think. Although during the regular season, when he came to Miami, I think his percentage was like 44 on 6 attempts per game. So, like, that's a 20-game sample size right there. So he's just been hitting shots, and we can look throughout his career and know he's an inconsistent and a streaky guy, but, like, maybe this just continues over the next month or so, or maybe he's got something special, something he's responding to in the bubble is impacting his ability to hit these shots. I don't know. But
he's just been waiting for a neutral site his entire life. This is his moment.
Exactly. 100%. And then, like, yeah, you look at Tyler Hero, who is a 20-year-old rookie, and, you know, they can fall off at any point. And Duncan Robinson, to your point, like, comparing him to a Kyle Korver or a J.J. Redick, someone who can be game-planned out of a series, I think that's fair. Like, when that happens, Eric Spoelstra just subs him out and subs in Andre Iguodala or any of the other guys off the bench who are pretty capable of impacting the game in different ways. So they're just like a really complimentary, tough team, I think. But I see your point with the fact that they just don't have the traditional star power.
Yeah, and so I also have some concerns actually about Jimmy Butler, to be honest, too, because I think he got a lot of attention for his big moments against Milwaukee and fully deserved. I mean, he was absolutely sensational late in game one, and I think it was late in game three that he closed out as well, right, with the big push. And I think actually, you know, he getting fouled on the last play of game two, I mean, his fingerprints are all over that. As that series wore on, though, his impact was a little bit more hit or miss to me. And I don't know if he was suffering from fatigue. I'm not sure exactly what was going on. He just seemed a little bit more passive than he did earlier in the games. And it had me a little bit nervous, I think, on behalf of Miami, where, you know, as we saw, like, they seized control of that series against Milwaukee because of Jimmy. His matchups are going to be pretty tough in the next round, kind of whoever it is, whether it's OG and Pascal or, you know, whether it's Tatum and Brown.
No, let's just say that it's gonna be OG and Pascal. I need some superstitious.
You want the reverse jinx? You want the reverse jinx? Yeah.
If I say that, then it's not a reverse jinx. So let's just say it's Pascal and OG. Let's just go there.
Well, I just think that's a tougher matchup for him, and as a smarter coach too. By the way, I mean, look, there's not going to be a situation where, you know, they're getting into, you know, post game debates about who should be guarding Jimmy. Toronto would know who they want to be guarding Jimmy, and it's not going to be some open for debate like, you know, forum casting call. Hey guys, who do we think Milwaukee should have guarding Jimmy? Like, they're going to have a better plan than the Bucks did. So his life is going to be more difficult, I suppose. You know, in some of those moments where he was, you know, not quite as impactful late in that series, which just had me a little bit nervous, because I do think you need to have him as the central presence of an Eastern Conference Finals if you're going to pull if you're going to pull what I believe would be considered an upset over either one of those teams. You know, another major advantage that Miami would have here. And, you know, maybe this is just like talking head, you know, water cooler stuff, but They've got the nobody believes in them card for sure. They've got a massive rest advantage, you know, for sure. And then they've got just, you know, a very shared identity and a real comfort down here in the bubble as well. I think other than Boston, I'm not sure of any other team in the bubble who's been happier and more content that's still here than Miami, right? I mean, they've, you know, they've talked about how it's a business trip. You know, they've stayed, you know, very focused and steady throughout their postseason run. Even when they got up on, you know, 2-0 on Milwaukee, it wasn't a lot of chest thumping at all, you know, and they did have the let up in game four. They definitely should have won that game. But, you know, Jimmy came out and said all the right things about how they sort of took their eye off the ball and didn't finish it and let up a little bit after Giannis got injured. And then they took care of business in game five. I'm wondering, do you think some of those, you know, psychological benefits coupled with all this rest, can that be a factor in an Eastern Conference Finals series where maybe they come out and get game one and or two just because, you know, they're chomping at the bit and they're well rested after another, you know, another team is coming through this long battle? Or is that just, you know, the classic rest versus rust talk that winds up not mattering too much?
I can't ever like get to like waste too much of my own mental energy on the rest versus rust debate, because like it just makes... There's just like we have nothing to go on right here. There's like no data. We like look at the Lakers, who had all this time to rest, and then they drop game one after the Houston Rockets are just in this dogfight seven game series hanging on for their lives. So I think like on one hand, you might be exhausted coming out of the series if you're Boston or Toronto. But on the other, your antennas have been up the whole time. So like I can talk myself into either side as being an advantage here. I do think your point about, you know, them having this, I guess, just this really nice bond together and collectively treating this with a type of focus that not a lot of organizations or not every team has been kind of treating the bubble, maybe. I mean, I look at, I guess, like we haven't even mentioned the Daniel House situation, but I would be shocked if like the Miami have something like that happening on the Miami Heat. It's probably the last team that I would expect it to happen on, just because they are so singularly focused and clearly on top of what they need to accomplish. But yeah, going back to like rest versus rest, I don't know if that matters at all, really.
Yeah, I hear you. We'll get to the house thing in a second. We got a quick question here from Orion. He says, I always enjoy your guys' takes, and you know, I love listening to the pod, but Eric Spoelstra would never play Giannis 44 minutes. And he is saying this in response to our conversation about what happens if you switch the coaches in that series. He says, Spoelstra is only playing Bam 36 minutes, and he's using sports science to kind of make those decisions. Why aren't you mentioning that? Why are you criticizing minutes restrictions on Giannis while not identifying his lack of playmaking? So here's the deal, Orion. When he had a Giannis-like figure named LeBron James, you know, during his prime, Spoelstra rode that guy 40-plus for multiple series over and over and over again. He let his superstars decide the title pushes you know, during those four straight finals runs. And I just think that Bam is awesome, all-star-level player, played great for long stretches of that second-round series. But it's almost a luxury to not have to push him. I think that Miami actually felt like they didn't need to run up their best players' minutes because they were in control of that series from start to finish. I'm not sure that's necessarily how it's going to play out once you get to the Eastern Conference Finals. As we're seeing, you know, both from Boston and Toronto, coaches eventually do tighten things up and go to their best players and lean more heavily on them. And I don't think Miami will be an exception there. But I also think that if Spoelstra was down 2-0 in a playoff series and he had Giannis, he's 1,000% playing him more than 36 minutes. There's no question. I think every other coach in the league besides Coach Bud would do the same thing. Do you agree, Michael?
100%. The president...
Okay, thank you. I thought I was going crazy. Or I don't know if Orion like gaslit me here or something, but I was like, come on, man.
No, I mean, like Pat Riley is the president of the Miami Heat. Do you think that if Giannis was there, which, you know, Giannis may be there sometime soon in a playoff series playing for that organization, like in a spot where they're trailing in a series, like he's not caring about minutes restrictions. And to the point about Bam only playing 36, like, yeah, they won their first seven games of the postseason. Like, they haven't had to put the pedal to the metal yet. Like, the whole point of us criticizing Bud and Giannis was that they had their backs against the wall and they stuck to the same substitution pattern. So that's like the whole point here.
Yeah, they were standing in the middle of a street. The truck was barreling down on them. We were screaming move, and he decided not to move. That's why we're mad. It's pretty straightforward. Hey, Michael, we had a lot of other questions about what's Milwaukee's future look like. Can they pursue a Chris Paul trade and all that? I want to bump those to next week because let's dig in a little bit to this Daniel House situation. Now, Chris Haynes of Yahoo Sports reported here, I believe Thursday morning, that it's possible that House wound up needing to sit Game 3 and his status is kind of questionable for Game 4 because he potentially invited a female testing employee, someone who's administering the coronavirus tests, into his hotel room here on campus. Now, the other reporting, I believe, from Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN said that House's, whatever his violation might have been here, did not involve him leaving the bubble, so we can kind of rule that out. You know, just in terms of how the health and safety protocols work here on campus, there aren't that many violations that you could have that would result in you being forced to miss time or re-quarantine if you don't leave or if you don't have contact with somebody from the outside world. The whole idea of these rules is basically to limit a direct player contact to people who haven't gone through the same quarantine and bubble process. They are very strict about no guests into hotel rooms, especially no overnight guests, unless they're the pre-approved, you know, wives and girlfriends and family members that have already gone through the quarantine process. And they are very strict about, you know, don't sneak anybody onto campus or anything of that nature. So as we wait for more details to emerge here on the Daniel House situation, I think it's just kind of fair framing to be like, it had to be something serious. This is not a case where he's, you know, walking around not wearing a mask or, you know, he's, you know, not staying socially distant or something like that. I mean, this has to be kind of a direct violation of what are those key core principles about their coronavirus plan, because otherwise they wouldn't feel the need to investigate and they wouldn't hold him out of Game 3. So I guess, Michael, this sort of begs a question. I mean, you mentioned that this would never happen for a member of the Miami Heat. There's just too much discipline in that organization. Are we surprised at all that this is the type of thing that would strike the Houston Rockets during the middle of a tense playoff series against the LA Lakers? I mean, I hate to pile on here because we just had 20 minutes of Tatum bashing, but does this say something about the Rockets culture, Michael?
I mean, yeah, I don't want to like posit it where just because the Heat are super focused, like the Rockets are not super focused, but it's just like
it's not the most it's not the most shocking thing in the world, I guess.
I'm not stunned that this has happened, I guess. And it's just super disappointing. And like, I don't know. We still don't know necessarily all the details exactly.
And it seems like that he's denying any wrongdoing. So obviously, you know, he is innocent until proven guilty. And, you know, everybody should kind of, maintain that mentality. I think that's kind of the right way to look at it. I guess the situation.
But we've got games to play. Like fact that they're doing this investigation, the league is right now, and they're potentially going to hold him out. They held him out for Game 3 and will potentially hold him out for Game 4. And he's like a huge player for them. This isn't like someone who only logs 5 minutes off the bench or 6 minutes off the bench or takes three shots a game. Like, he's a humongous piece for them.
He's probably their fourth most important player, wouldn't you say, right now?
He's their sixth man. And when he's on the floor, they can really switch everything. And when he's on the floor for Westbrook, they have literally five guys who can shoot threes and drive and defend basically every position. So he's huge. And I don't even know, like, when we talk with this kind of relates to whether or not they'll bench Russ, right? And like, Daniel House was always the answer to that question. Where if they do bench Russ, he's the guy who's going to be on the floor. So if he's not available, then you go to Austin Rivers, who has not really played very well and has seemingly lost Mike D'Antoni's trust with just looking at the minutes and how is he's been involved in the rotation. Do you go to Ben McLemore? Like, these guys are capable players for sure, but they're just not quite as good fits against the Lakers, I think. So it's like a huge, huge loss.
Yeah, and he's been playing pretty well, too. I guess what we can say is, you know, innocent until proven guilty, but there was clearly enough evidence that the NBA made the extraordinary decision to take him out of Game 3. You know, knowing the stakes and the possible blowback from a decision like that, they had to feel confident that they had him, right? Because otherwise, you're risking just an all-time controversy by influencing a player's availability in a playoff series, especially against the Lakers, right? I mean, the last thing the NBA league office wants to have is the perception that they have their thumb on the scale on behalf of LeBron in a playoff series by, like, you know, taking away players from the opposing team. I mean, that's really, really bad optics. So I think in this situation, they must have felt comfortable that, you know, something serious had gone wrong. And from that standpoint, it's probably fair or getting close to fair to say that he let his teammates down. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, I think he made some comments recently that he was one of the most slept on players. I think he even brought pillows into the analogy about how underrated he was. I appreciated his attempts at, you know, creative writing and speaking. I think he was right. You know, I look past Harden, Westbrook, and PJ Tucker. I feel like he's pretty much one of their most important players, if not the most important guy. After those big three, in terms of are they going to be able to win this series, to me, it feels like a very bad omen for Houston. And you never want to write those guys off. I don't think they're necessarily done in this series, but I feel like, you know, this is now fully in the Lakers' control. How are you feeling on your Houston Rockets anxiety? And I've been pushing all of your buttons today, but I guess zooming back, bigger picture, with the Lakers up 2-1 headed into Game 4 tonight, is this something that's got you nervous?
Am I nervous? I mean, it's basically a must-win game. I don't really like saying that whenever it's truly not a must-win elimination game, but
I think, I find I have a different take. Every game in life is a must-win game. Michael, this podcast is a must-win game, all right? Go out there with the mentality that you're trying to win no matter what, and you'll be so much better served. If you just go out there and this is a kind of win game, you're going to be just jogging through life, not getting the most out of yourself. Today is a must-win day. Tomorrow is a must-win day. Now I'm sounding like Chip Kelly saying win the day. But look, every game is a must-win game. Why do we keep score if it's not a must-win game?
Point taken, Ben. Every game, every day, every minute, must win.
You sound so sick to me right now, Michael. It's unbelievable.
But to get back to your initial question, I think I am a little nervous. I'm not going to lie. Game 3, honestly, in the second half of game 2, I was pretty confident after the Rockets came back and closed that lead. In game 3, it was basically a toss-up game back and forth through three quarters, and then Rondo just kind of came out of nowhere. And so in a playoff series, I don't know. Can LeBron hit the type of shots that he hit in game 3 again and do all of that? Can they summon, and when I say they, I mean the Lakers, can they summon some production out of another role player who I've probably discounted weeks ago to come up big as Markieff Morris did earlier in this series? I don't know. I think it comes back to I don't know if surprise is the right word, but I thought that Westbrook athletically would have it a little bit more and that they would not play him until he was at 100%. I don't think he's even close to 100%, and that is just evident in how he's playing basketball and shooting threes and just not trusting his body in a way that he did earlier in the season. So that's kind of the bigger, the more thing I'm worried about than even necessarily that the series is 2-1. Just Westbrook doesn't look right, and I don't know how they win if he doesn't look right.
I'm with you, especially if House's availability is compromised. I mean, that's just, you know, it's putting even more and more on Harden. And he's been good, but not absolutely spectacular. I mean, I think Houston's best stretch there was that third quarter of game three, or like the best stretch, you know, from that game. And they looked absolutely awesome. Can they sustain that, I think, is an open question. We'll get some answers tonight. You know, Denver last night just kind of died on the vine to me. You know, that kind of felt like a back-breaking loss for them to go down 3-1. Now, the Clippers weren't celebrating like they had won the series yet, but clearly they're in full control. Will we see history repeat tonight and the Lakers kind of go to the same position? That remains to be seen, but that's kind of what I'm expecting at this point. It's unfortunate because I think I had – well, I don't want to write the series off yet, but I think I expected a little bit more from this series in terms of entertainment value and back and forth than we've gotten so far. I guess maybe the Celtics and Raptors are setting such an impossibly high standard that everything else feels like kind of a disappointment compared to them. But, you know, like Rondo and Markieff Morris, you know, putting away the Rockets was not exactly the headline that I was hoping for from this particular matchup, but that's okay. Hey, Michael, let's close on a more serious note. We've obviously been tracking the player protests and the impact of that all summer long. Michael writes in, not you, to say, "Today and tomorrow, university teachers across the country are taking part in a scholar strike. You can read their letter above, but this is a day where teachers are walking off virtually or in person from college campuses to say that we are not going to carry on as usual when black people are systemically killed by police. In most of the communications about the scholar strike, the NBA and WNBA are specifically mentioned as inspirations. This strike is happening because of what the Bucks and other teams did. So I'm writing to you guys for two reasons. I would like you to amplify the brave work these teachers are doing. In some states, it is illegal for teachers to walk off the job. University teachers, many of whom are adjuncts in precarious positions, are risking their livelihoods in a pandemic because they will not teach chemistry, physics, and music when their students feel unsafe around the police. This was also inspired because the Bucks transgressed. The Bucks did something that upset the status quo, and the teachers were inspired to jump in. Missing that game was more important than just names on the jerseys or choreographed kneeling. NBA-approved protests doesn't necessarily inspire action from others. There's a difference between striking in the bubble and these other conversation starters. Don't get me wrong, I do think kneeling matters. It starts conversation. But striking started action. I think it's important to point out to all basketball fans so they can see the brave actions of NBA and WNBA players and that impact they're having outside their world. CNN, for example, is writing about the teacher's strike, and it could get bigger and bigger as more people get excited and join in. So, Michael, what did you think of Michael's email here and the possible trickle-down impacts of the Bucks strike? You know, we had talked about how their action kind of changed it from a D1 sports story, you know, in the Washington Post to an A1, you know, national news story. And there are implications for that kind of a move. Certainly their decision to not play was probably the signature moment, I would say. It's probably going to be the most memorable moment of this entire bubble experience, the biggest story that the NBA has drawn headlines with. Do you think that this kind of inspiration of other workers will continue? And what did you make of the teacher's decision that Michael laid out here?
Yeah, I think that it's terrific. I should say, first of all, I think that, you know, if the Milwaukee Bucks are inspiring others to behave in the same way and stand up for what they believe in and leverage the power that they have at their jobs to draw attention to issues that they care about, then that is super awesome and really important. And we should also at the same time acknowledge the risks that they have. I'm talking about the teachers who are doing this and how strong you need to be collectively to pull something like this off
I mean, the max salaries and the minimum salaries for teachers are a little different than the max salaries and the minimum salaries for NBA players, right? So I think what his point is, even if you're a university professor, you might not have, you know, tenure, and you know, you could be in a situation where it's pretty easy for your employer to cut bait if they wanted to. And that's a gigantic risk that I don't think, you know, even the Bucks really faced, honestly.
Right, for sure. And so, you know, I think that this is great. I mean, I you know, anytime, like I just said, anytime you're drawing attention to an issue that is really important and an injustice in the world, like the way that they're going about it, I think is very positive and powerful. So for the Bucks to inspire this just kind of doubly makes what they did that much more meaningful. And, you know, it's you hope that as we go down the line in history, that the legacy of that moment will continue to see similar instances as what we're seeing with the scholarly strike.
Yeah, I think what's so fascinating to me is that I really don't think the Bucks envisioned that this would happen, right? Like, I think that they were just really caught up in that particular moment of being really, really upset. They didn't feel comfortable playing the game. They felt it would just sat wrong with them. They came to the decision in the hours before not playing about what they were going to do. I think they were even caught off guard by the immediate reaction in terms of the other athletes joining them around different sports. And I imagine
can I cut you off really quickly? Like,
yes,
do
please.
You act? I mean, I know you just said that you think that, but do you really like? I know that it came together so fast, and George Hill basically was just like, "I'm not playing," and then Sterling Brown's like, "I'm not playing," and then it snowballs. But how do you not know? I mean, these are all smart guys. How do they not know that this is going to be like a wildly impactful, influential, noteworthy, newsworthy move? I just don't. I don't believe that. It's unprecedented. And they know that.
No, I think that they knew that it never had been done before. But you don't know how everyone's going to respond. You could never predict that, right? And I think mind, like, we know that they didn't give a courtesy heads up to the other teams that were scheduled to play. So probably in their minds, they're thinking those other games are going to go on. I think that they were probably thinking, well, hey, we'll just forfeit this game and then we'll pick up the rest of our series on down the road, right? I'm not sure that they gave thought that, like, you know, AOC and Trump and all these people are going to be weighing in instantly to the decision, or that, you know, the media from all around the world is going to treat this as the number one story, not just sports story, because they've got a lot going on here. Look, they're isolated from the rest of the outside world. They're living day by day, hour by hour in the bubble. It definitely warps your perspective of how things will be, you know, received from everyone else. They're cut off from even their own direct family members, so it's not like they could even just run this by somebody on a heart-to-heart conversation, right? You know, you could use FaceTime to do that, I guess, the night before, but you're not still in the same kind of a perspective-building moment that you would be if you weren't in the bubble. I'm not saying that they didn't believe there was going to be a reaction, but to me, to have the size and scope of the reaction and the instantaneous reaction with all the other athletes joining in, followed by now, you know, this teachers movement, I think if you, you know, told George Hill, like, do you think that there's going to be all these college professors just not showing up to work because you decided you didn't want to play following Jacob Blake's shooting? I'm pretty sure he would be like, no, I didn't see that coming. And how could he? I didn't see it coming. Did you?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, your point is well taken, no.
So, I mean, I think that actually makes it even more interesting, because it turns this whole thing into like an organic movement, an organic protest. And I think when you look back at the history from the 60s, wouldn't you say that's kind of how a lot of it unfolded, right? When you're talking about, you know, bus boycotts and, you know, Rosa Parks, it's like, you know, at some point these were not like crazy calculated months in advance decisions. Like, you take an action, you see what the reaction is, and then you push forward with the next action. I think it just puts the NBA players, you know, in a leadership position for sure. It definitely solidifies their stance there, and it gives them a takeaway as well. And they've been looking for that, by the way. You know, we've heard from players and coaches, how can we make a difference? Wouldn't you agree that this is kind of you know, evidence that they've left a mark?
Oh, without question. I think in the you know, not to go down a rabbit hole, but in the conversation about like how to leverage your platform, you know, they've done a lot of really good things, but this, you know, in 20 years, are we really going to remember the slogans on the back of the jerseys? Or are we going to remember the fact that the Milwaukee Bucks staged a boycott? Like, I think that is way more powerful Not necessarily to compare the two, but even though I just did.
No, compare the two. I think you're dead right. Like, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's Michael the emailer's point too here, right?
Yeah, I think that that is for sure what Michael the emailer was trying to convey. And again, it's just it's an awesome thing that they did. And I hope that we kind of keep building from here.
I'm right there with you. All right, Michael, we have reached the end of another episode of Open Floor. Guys, let us know what you think about the Rockets melting down, the Celtics melting down, the amazing leadership shown by the Bucks players. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. We will be back early next week to pick up the pieces on Raptors Celtics and preview the Eastern Conference Finals and possibly the Western Conference Finals if we have answers in those series as well. Michael, we are hitting the home stretch here of the bubble playoffs. The games are ramping up in intensity and we're narrowing the field almost day by day. Guys, check us out on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review, tap 5 stars, and leave us some kind words. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Now, Michael's on Twitter and Instagram at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golver, on Twitter at Ben Golver. Check out my Washington Post newsletter. You can sign up for that on my Twitter page. There's a link there. Michael, anything you want to plug here that you've been writing? It feels like you're pumping out, what, 2-3 pieces a day? You're a machine.
So actually, I guess hopefully this goes up. Our episode goes up today on Thursday, but I just wrote a piece that should be published within like the next 10 minutes where I talked to the last Rondo superfan alive, who is not me. And that was a really fun conversation. And so go check that out at GQ.
I have to imagine if the Rockets go down at the hand of Rondo, that's like the only possible way you're going to be able to kind of, you know, make sense of your loss prediction. Am I right? Like, is this the only possible way you'd actually be happy if Houston loses?
If playoff Rondo is a thing consistently, the fact that he plays for the Lakers is just like a real dual-edged sword in my heart that I can't ever reconcile. So it's all really tough, and it's an emotional paradox that I can't really come to grips with, to be honest with you.
Your favorite player of all time on your least favorite team, possibly taking down your favorite team in the finals. Can you imagine if the Lakers beat the Celtics, Michael? How many conflicted feelings?
Just stop right there. We're not going there.
All right. End of the podcast, guys. Thanks for listening. Hey, Michael, until next week, I'll talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy and Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.